I've been told that the area in front of and maybe including where Memorial Library now stands used to be General Athletic Field. What was it used for when you came?
Well, when I came to school, we had hockey games there, and of course where the present library is was our ticket office at 711 Langdon. We earlier had the ticket office in what was the health clinic on the corner of Park and Langdon, where the Memorial Union now stands. And later, Patty King also had her student employment office in that building. We used to go in there and buy our football tickets at 50 cents. But in 1926, they moved the ticket office from there to an old building that had been constructed many, many years before. And I know that we had several safes in the building, and I always thought that one day I would come in and walk down into the basement to open the safe rather than on the first floor, because the girders were not very sturdy. But on the lower campus, which was a general area for the softball and for play during the spring and summer for the general student body, we had our hockey rink. And the hockey rink, of course, had temporary bleachers, and we would put canvas around the back of the bleachers and use samovars in order to get a little heat into the bleachers, try to make the spectators a little more comfortable. But as we saw in this February thaw, usually about first part of February, and we would try to play our games, but we usually had to wait till 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night before we could start our games, because the rinks would melt, and we had to wait until we got a little colder weather in the late evening in order to play our hockey games. We did have a little booth there where we sold our tickets, and Joe Steinauer used to broadcast on radio the hockey games. He had a little shack there alongside of the hockey rink, and Joe Steinauer, who was our swimming coach, of course, as most of you know for many years, did some broadcasting there, as well as broadcasting for WHA and later for WIBA and in the football stadium. That area, of course, years before actually had some football games played on it. I understand that the Minnesota game, in fact I've seen some pictures of Minnesota games and Chicago games being played on the lower campus. Needless to say, it was a matter of for the spectators to stand around the perimeter of the field rather than have bleachers erected there, because the student body was using that area, as I say, for softball games or for general play, general recreation. And of course the locker rooms in the gymnasium were handy so that they could change their clothes and run over to the lower campus. The lower campus, of course, was used for, on our homecoming, we would have our big bonfire there, and the State Street merchants would cooperate in saving boxes. They used boxes in those days for receiving all their equipment rather than the cardboard that we use today. But the wooden boxes mm-hmm. were readily available then to build our bonfire. And of course that was started after our pep rally, and was a part of the pep rally, after which usually the students had a parade up State Street and around the square. The area was also used, what we called in the old days, for the bag rush. The sophomores and the freshmen would have a bag rush on a particular Saturday afternoon in the fall, and preceding the bag rush, the sophomores would attempt to spirit the freshmen away the night before, so that their forces were not as large as the sophomore force. In fact, when I was a student in 1924, and of course this happened in the fall of 24, they spirited away Clyde Kluckholm, who was our class president. and we didn't have him available to lead us into the bag rice that day, but the sophomores would get the hoses and wet the field so that it got awfully sloppy. And the W men would usually have short billy clubs and stand behind the freshmen and also the sophomores to goad them on and force them into the fight. It was a matter of moving the bags to a certain line, and it rather developed in seeing who can tear off the most clothes, because it was really a bedraggled looking group after the bag rush had been completed, and that was usually the morning of a football game, so that the alumni who had no doubt participated in years before the bag rush could come and see the festivities. We also used it for cap night. That the freshmen in those days wore a little green cap with a little red button on the top of it, and those were sold at the co-op, and most freshmen did wear them. The sophomores, of course, would be in cars, and they would run around the square down State Street, and if they'd see a freshman, they would, in many cases, pick them up into the car, take them down, throw them in the lake. But I know I had a rather fortunate incident for me. I'd lost my cap in one of my classrooms and was walking up near the old Parkway Theater, and sophomores were coming along in the car and yelling, "There's a freshman," and of course I had no cap, so they grabbed a couple of freshmen who were along the Long Mifflin Street there and took them down and threw them in the lake. But that, of course, and the hazing at the Sterndies has all gone by the boards now, but it was an interesting period, and there was a little class rivalry between the freshmen and sophomores, and of course as we passed a sophomore, he would yell, "Button, freshman," and we were supposed to touch the button on the top of our cap. And we were the lowly freshmen, and the sophomores, of course, had assumed senior status, so that we did. But the lower campus filled a good use for our hockey games and for general skating. We flooded the athletic department, had charge of that area, and did flood the rinks, and so that the general student body could have a skating area, of course, and we needed the hockey facilities. We erected the rink each year and played our hockey games there. I recall standing out there, being out there, of course, selling tickets, and it was about zero, and we had about 500 people just standing outside watching a Michigan hockey game, so that the heat which we try to generate under the bleachers didn't help too much. I do recall that Dr. Meanwell came out onto the ice just after practice and looked over the stands, and just previous to that time, one of the pucks and flown into the stands and hit Lycan Miller, who was one of our basketball stars, and hit him over the eye and gave him a cut. And Doc Meanwell came out, and he was looking for his basketball boys and tell him to get out of the hockey rink. We don't want any more injuries. So. But we did enjoy all those facilities and enjoyed the comradeship and the play which we generated on the lower campus.
How long did that go on?
Well, Wisconsin had hockey until 1935. During the war years, or during the Depression rather, I should say, we had to cut back, and we dropped some sports from an intercollegiate basis, and hockey was one of them. We did, however, provide the money which was received from the sale of football programs and turned that over to Guy Lohman, who was in charge of professional course, and at that time in 35, of course, was in charge of physical education required work as well. So we did turn that money over to Guy Lohman, and he doled it out to the various sports, tennis and hockey and golf and gave them sufficient money to maybe have a meal or two on their trips, or to provide some money for gas and oil for their cars, which the students would drive themselves. But it was a program which the athletic department, intercollegiate department, could not carry at that time. And we felt, rather than drop it, this was a solution, feeling that the students who participated in these so-called minor sports would not be too demanding. If they were on an intercollegiate basis, they would demand what the other students are getting. Well, we're running into a similar situation. Hoping for, the women now, with women's athletics, are hoping for the equivalent of what the men get on the intercollegiate sports. But in those days, we did feel that the club sports were the solution to continue these activities, because we did feel that it was good to have all of our students, or as many as wished, to participate in sports. Although it was intercollegiate in a way, because they did meet other schools, Northwestern and Minnesota, the schools who were close by. We didn't do much traveling to Ohio State at that time, because it was a little far for the club sports. But we did have some money, around $4,000, and as I say, it was doled out sparingly by Guy Lohman's department to assist the students who wished to participate on a club sport basis.
Did the other universities that Wisconsin played have a sort of similar club arrangement?
I believe that some of them felt the pinch just as we did, but I don't think to the extent that we had to go. I don't think they dropped them. They seemed to have sufficient money. We were in a period where football wasn't paying too well, and as a result, our finances were down, and it did help out the situation, Terry. But in 1935, we did have to drop hockey, because we were running into a situation that in February, we could hold our January events, but in February we had to postpone or call off some of our hockey games because of the weather that we seemed to run into in mid-February. And of course we depended entirely on the freezing temperatures in order to keep our hockey and our skating rinks in shape. We did not have a cover, of course, over that, which might have helped some, but because if the sun came out, it would immediately start melting our ice. So it was an effort to keep things going, because we did have 13 sports on the campus, including cruise and the so-called minor sports, or the major sports in those days, were actually football, basketball, cross-country, crew. And track, of course. Those were the so-called major sports. The minor sports, of course, were the gymnastics teams and tennis and golf and so on. And we gave major W's only in the major sports at that time. The minor W, so-called minor W, which was a smaller W, and did not carry the privileges that the major W had, such as free attendance at athletic events and that sort of thing. But they were given a minor W. In later years, the all sports were considered major sports, and although a minor W was given, it was given on the basis of participation. For instance, for football, they would have to play 60 minutes in the season in order to get a major W, or be recommended for a major W. And if they played less than that, then they could be awarded a minor W. We had more cases where even major W winners would receive a minor W. I know in one case, Tom Jones, who was the track coach, in the third year of participation, he gave
one of his athletes, a minor W, and the boy complained. He said, why? He said, I've had a major W the last 2 years. Why do I get a minor W this year? And Coach Jones' answer was, well, you participated just like that, a minor W participation. You were the major participant in your track.
So it wasn't just the sport, it was how much the student put in.
Yeah, there were regulations for time played. In basketball, it was a game and a half. In hockey, or in baseball, it would be, for its pitcher would have to put in 1.5 to 2 full games. In the catcher would have to put in probably 3 games. Outfielders, infielders would put in the equivalent of 3 to 4 games, or participated in the major, at least more than half of the games were played in order to get a major W, be recommended for one. The student board had the sole privilege of approving the W's, and that would be taken, their recommendation would be taken to the athletic board, since the athletic board was in charge of finances, and it was only because of that that they approved the recommendation of the student board, because the students would receive a sweater with a W, or a blanket with a W on, or a jacket, or in the case of seniors, a senior ring. But there was a regulation for each sport as to how much they had to participate in order to earn the major or minor W. Freshmen, of course, we didn't have freshman competition on varsity teams, and they, of course, were recommended for numerals. And they could give, for instance, football, they could give 44 numerals. That meant they were actually taking care of four football teams. In basketball, it was 15. 15 numerals could be given out. And the other sports, it varied. So. But there was a standard regulation for each sport as to how much they had to participate in order to receive a major, minor, or numeral. If you stayed out the entire season, you as a freshman, you were no doubt eligible for a numeral, but it was not compulsory for the coach. The coach made the recommendation in conjunction with the captain of the team. So today, of course, it's pretty much on recommendation of the coach and the captain.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more value was put to the W, because I know the W men student athletic board was made up of the captains of the various sports, and they were very niggardly about giving out an award if it wasn't justified. The coach might have some favorites, but the boys would knock it out if they felt that the boy hadn't participated enough.
Oh, I see.
So they were very very careful and prized their W. Now with grants and aid, I don't know if they prize it as much as they did before, because they were pretty much on their own and weren't getting a lot of help, especially in the minor sports.
Another sport I've been curious about is what's happening to fencing.
Well, fencing is still continuing. Archie Simonson, who was our fencing coach for a while, is now, of course, a judge. He lost out in the circuit court race yesterday, but he brought fencing along quite well. Years ago, Art Masley, who was in charge of physical education required work, was fencing coach for many years and was quite successful. And the one good thing about these fencers is that they can continue their competition after they have graduated. And we have quite a few of our Wisconsin boys have a fencing club in Milwaukee, and they come over and compete with our fencing team yearly. Of course, when Archie Simonson assumed the judgeship, he was, we had to bring in another man, and we have good competition with the conference schools. Only six of them have fencing. Minnesota does not have fencing. I don't think Northwestern has fencing. Indiana doesn't have fencing, and I believe Purdue. There's four schools that do not have fencing. So if, when you have a conference meet, you're only participating with five other schools. But we have had the fencing meet here many times, and the competition has been good. It's a sport, of course, that most boys learn here. It's like crew. You don't get the fencer or the crewman. The crewman, we used to take out the physical education lines or physical education classes and break them in, give them many hours on the water. And fencing is similar to that. It's a good sport for a lot of boys who want competition. Football, basketball, who do not feel they're quite big enough or not agile enough for varsity competition, but they do want to participate. And it's a good outlet for those young athletes that do not feel that they're big enough for football or for basketball. And so that's where Archie and the present fencing coach have recruited their boys, and they have to teach them.
They learn it here.
They learn it here, yes. And it's a good sport. One thing, the boys are very enthusiastic about fencing because they go out on many meets unattached. And they can, it's a sport where they can compete unattached. So they're out about every week.
What do you mean by unattached?
Well, they'll go down to Chicago, maybe meet a Chicago fencing club or Milwaukee fencing club. They aren't representing the university, you see.
Oh, I see.
So that they can meet other non-university teams, you see, or non-university competition, or open competition in fencing. So they go under their own name rather than under the name of the University of Wisconsin.
I see.
But they do get a lot of additional practice, a lot of competition that way. So it's. Well, the kids that are in fencing are very enthusiastic. And, of course, we have a girls' fencing team, too.
That's Archie, new, I imagine.
Well, Archie Simonson started the girls quite a few years ago, but they were interested in a lot of them under the women's department before they become under the intercollegiate department. They did have come over, and Archie would work with the girls. Keep some fencing. It's a good sport. Doesn't draw many spectators, but it draws the friends of the fencers and their folks.
It's not a moneymaker, in other words.
Not a moneymaker. We always told Archie what he should do is do like they did in the movies and have the boys chase each other up and down the bleachers in the field house. We might get a crowd that way, draw a little blood.
Well, I've been reading lately that our swimming team has been doing pretty well, too.
Yes, since we got Chris, Joe Steinhauer, and years ago, and when we used to play water polo and had swimming team, we had some very good swimmers in those days, even in the old pool. Fellows like Pedersen and Kratz and fellows of that stature who made our conference. But John Hickman, who's now one of our counselors, was a fencing coach for a number of years. But Elroy brought in Jack Pettinger, who was an assistant to councilman of Indiana. And since we've had Jack, and of course with the new facilities, it has helped tremendously because we can attract the swimmers from the state schools now. And swimming again too is being pursued very, very rapidly by the schools, high schools of the state, because as you know, when they're building high schools now and gymnasiums, many schools are putting in swimming indoor swimming facility, so that we do have a good good outlet for our Wisconsin swimmers. Although there are our out-of-state boys that, that are recruited for our swimming team. And probably second or third to Indiana. In fact, we've been very fortunate. Ohio State was a power for many years, and I think that Wisconsin is the equal of Ohio State and a few of the other schools now. We have good facilities and a good diving pool, so our divers have done very well. And of course, they used to be down to Lauderdale during spring vacation, but this year, during Christmas vacation, they took the team over to Hawaii and swam there in competition.
What a wonderful time of year to go.
What a wonderful time to go. And but Jack Pettinger has recruited some good athletes, although we've lost some good boys. We lost a fellow by the name of Montgomery. We lost him to Madison Boy. We lost him to California schools. And he's a top-notcher, but I think good Pettinger figures that in the conference meet this year he should play second or third. Indiana's pretty hard to beat. Councilman is. They've thrown a lot of scholarships. Of course, it's limited now, but they were throwing a lot of scholarships to swimming in Indiana and became a power, and probably number one in the nation under Councilman. But Jack is doing a terrific job, and our swimmers are making very good progress in that sport. There again, we have a limited capacity. We can hold about 1,200-1,300 there for swimming, and for the most part it's crowded when they have a swimming meet there. And of course now with intercollegiate, the women are participating along with the men, and not with the men, but at the time of the meet they're meeting the women from other schools, you see, in competition. As they're doing in track, they're also doing that in track. Our track meet last week and week before had competition for them. And I know at our Penn and Mike Club the other day, somebody was saying the worst meet they've ever seen, or the worst race, was the women's 2 mile. They thought it would take forever. But to me, a 2 mile race is a long race, even for the men.
I wouldn't want to run 2 miles, or race 2 miles.
No, it takes so much time. And not too much interest. The dashes, of course, are the interesting races in track.
Well, track is another one of these sports that apparently has been long history here at the university.
Yes, under Tom Jones, we had two, who was our track coach, probably for 30 years or more. He came to us in 1912, and of course, we had to run in the old annex for many, many years until we had the field house, and then now the Camp Brennan Memorial Practice Building. Tom had some great athletes over the years, and both like Doc Tormey, who held the indoor record of 40 yard dash for many years, Chuck Finsky, who was a great miler and was in the Olympic Games. And Wally Mayo, who's a minister now up in the East Coast. And Dykey, who's a great cross-country man. And Chapman, a great cross-country man. Kubli of Monroe, who started the Swiss Colony, was our captain in 1926, and was very instrumental in starting our W Club room under the stadium, which is a nice addition for the W Club men to come on game days and visit each other. And, but Tom had a great record, and we had one case. I know Tom Jones's brother-in-law was Williams, who was the coach at Missouri. And at one time, we wanted to have a meet. They wanted to have a meet with Missouri, or Missouri wanted to have a meet with Wisconsin, Notre Dame. Because the coach at Notre Dame had been at Missouri, and Tom had been at Missouri years before. But we had a colored boy on our squad by the name of Smith. And of course, Missouri being so close to the Mason-Dixon line didn't have colored athletes in there. And there was some question, and I think the problem was Tom was probably going to tell the boy that he wasn't quite ready and leave him home. But there was evidently a letter written that was on Tom Jones's desk, and mentioning that there might be a problem with a colored athlete. In those days there were problems. But either the boy or somebody from the Cardinals saw the letter, and it came out in the papers that the boy might not be able to participate. And as a result, that meet was called off, because they didn't want to honor these three men at the time. But as a result, the athletic board then took action to the effect that any Wisconsin team would participate as a unit. And if they did not accept the entire team, there would be no competition. In fact, we had two boys on our basketball team going on the week on the Rice. And those boys were taken to a home of some wealthy colored people. And they were really treated, wined and dined, much better than our white boys, who had to stay in a hotel or a motel.
Oh, that's
but,
nice.
Yeah, so it had some reverse reactions too. But as a result, that happened. But Williams, we had a boy here, Bill Exum, who played football and was quite a dash man. Bill is now a great fellow, and he's an athletic director at one of the southern schools, colored school, and on many NCAA committees. But when Williams saw Bill Exum, he told Tom, he said, "Tom," he says, "you don't have very many of them, but when you get them, you really get them black." And Bill was just a grand fellow. But he participated here in football and in basketball and did very well in both. We always laughed at William's remark about Bill. Bill knows, and I've told him that several times. We run into him at NCAA meetings.
Of course.
But, with the new track now, because of the renovating of the inside of the practice building, we cannot hold as many people as we used to. Before, we had the hockey rink there. We could put our temporary bleachers on the tennis courts, and we could with an indoor track meet, the conference indoor track meet, we had 4,200 people in there. But now, if we get 1,600 people in there, we've got a crowd, because we don't have the area. The hockey rink has taken up 100 feet of the 400 foot building, and the track, of course, needs the entire 300 feet to put in an 8-mile track, so that we cannot put bleachers on the south end anymore. And the fold-up bleachers that are there will only hold about 1,500 people. But those are 15 rows and fold right into the wall, so we're right up near the wall, so that they make the area underneath available for additional recreation purposes. Our track meet the other day, I think, had about 1,600 people in. And they do have some standing room, but that isn't the best way to watch a track meet, standing on the side, because you miss too much of the activity. But we've had some great ones. Matt Storff, of course, our high jumper, who is now competing for the Wisconsin Track Club. He's graduated. The new coach, Bill Perrin, and Dan McLennan, who handles our cross country. He's had very good success in cross country. And the Bill came primarily as a weight man with weights and pole vaulting. He's a good coach in pole vaulting. So the Dan handles most of the distance boys. But I think last year we ran, I think, third in the conference. we've done very, done much better in the indoors than outdoors. Although we do have that grass tips track out there, which is a quarter mile track. But cutting down on the spectators may, well, it doesn't hurt the track activities itself, but it limits the number of people who can watch track, and as a result, the interest may wane somewhat. They do have a track club, but the track club usually have a lunch in the W Club Annex there before the meet, and then go over in a mass, and I think they're holding some seats for them now, so that they can move into seats. But this track club has created some interest and has been helpful in promoting track here in Wisconsin.
You mentioned a moment ago that we didn't have at one time very many black athletes. It certainly isn't the case anymore.
No, it's changed. Of course, part of it has changed. The attitude of the Southerners has changed quite a bit too. That they are accepting more colored athletes, and of course. It's been part of the difficulty has been getting them in school too. With our grant made and with our regulations, they must be able to attain a 1.6. And as a result, we do lose some that might otherwise good athletes, but probably not as good students that we would like to have them. So that some of the other schools that not in the conference, of course, because that's a or in the NCAA, but some schools will accept them, and of course with this underprivilege too, that we do accept some with the hope that they can attain 1.6. And we've had some cases here. We had a basketball player that we brought in on probation, but he could not compete the first year, and it was necessary to bring him along. He was short in some course in math, I think, and some other course, and they had to bring him along until he could attain the 1.6, and then of course he would be eligible to play. But I think for the most part, are in the educational system, they're probably a little better treated than they used to be, and I think it's rather unfair that they haven't, in many cases, haven't been provided the best teachers to handle them, and as a result, they have some difficulty in attaining that 1.6 prediction, and they haven't had the educational advantages that the white boys have had. So they're not too far away from the slave days. Of course, it is over 100 years, but at the same time, I guess it takes a long time to generation to generation to bring up their educational standards. I hope that will be corrected, because we've had a lot of nice colored boys here on our campus that have participated. And, they're fine. Some of them feel they've been underprivileged. I mean, they have a chip on their shoulder, some of them, but for the most part, I think we've had good relationships with them on our athletic teams. A few years ago, there was some talk that they were not meeting, but not getting together with each other. But I think as a younger generation is with them in school, I think I know one of our football coaches' family was the little boy came home and he was telling about the cute little girl at school. And he'd walked back and forth to school there, and finally one day he came in and he said, "Mother," he said, "you know," he said, "Sally's colored." And here all this time he'd been walking back, never thought. And I'm afraid that the adults are a little responsible for some of that too, calling the attention of the younger people that he's colored. But youngsters don't pay any attention to that. I know we've been happy, but fellows like Levant Weaver, who's on the basketball team, is now an assistant coach, and Bob Lee, who's on our football staff, doctor's degree in education, and just a grand fellow. And Les Richardson, who was on our staff for a while, is now, and when Harrington brought him here, I think he promised him that he would have tenure here for at least 5 years. And when we had a coaching change, he was taken up into the administration and does some consulting now. He said, I like Les. I don't know what's any of them. And I haven't met the new coach. We have a new colored coach, but I haven't met him yet in football. But I know if John Jardine picked him, he's got to be a good fellow. But as you say, we haven't had too many colored athletes. We have two on the basketball team this year, and one of them couldn't make the grade at semester time, so he's off. So the basketball team is operating normally. Football, we have quite a few. Track, of course, they seem to have in their physical makeup a little more speed. And as some coaches would say, they're a little hungrier than the white boys. They haven't had the advantages of the white boys. And they're a little hungrier and work a little harder, because they know that they've got to overcome some obstacles. And I think the grant and aid has helped quite a bit too, because now they can come in, if they can appoint have the 1.6 prediction there. They're assured of room, board, tuition, and books, and I think that's helped the situation.
Do you think? Are you in favor of athletic scholarships?
Well, I had liked the need. I'm, of course, going back to the old school that the boys came to play. And although they did get some help, they came to the institution because they wanted to come to the institution. Now we go out and recruit them. I think it's probably fair that if, just because a fella's father has lots of money, that he shouldn't be given the same recognition. If he's going to participate, some of them feel it, well, if he's going to participate, why shouldn't he get the same as the other boys get, who are probably not as fortunate to have a virtual amount of money. We had a case some years ago when it was on the need basis, that the father felt that if the boy was not on a scholarship, he would not get the recognition from the coaches.
Never occurred to me.
Well, and he actually paid through the foundation the amount of money that the athletic department would have to expend for his scholarship. But he wanted his son on scholarship. But he paid for it indirectly. But there has been some feeling in some parts that the boy would not, if he wasn't on scholarship, which meant that you went after him. If he was a walk-on, he wouldn't be given as much consideration as the fellow that the coach went out and actually wanted. So you can see that there could be that feeling in the minds of some folks.
Do you feel there's any justification for this feeling?
No, I don't, because after all, the coach wants to get the best athlete he can to participate. And if a boy is good, he's going to use him, no question about that. But the boy comes as a walk-on, he works out with the other fellows, he has the same chance, he's given the same consideration. If he's good, he's going to play. There's no coach in the world that is going to say, because you're not on scholarship, and you're better than the other guy on scholarship, that you aren't going to play that game. You're going to get in there. After all, the coach is, it's too bad, but it's a win or die league. It's too bad. We have fine gentlemen like John Paulus that is not winning. He as Elroy said, he saw the handwriting on the wall and felt that the opposition would be there and that people would want him replaced. So he resigned before they had a chance to dump him. But as a credit to the institution, and when they gave him a 2-year contract, extended his contract 2 years ago, I happened to be out of the country at the time, and I wrote to Elroy and I thanked him for appointing John again. I said, that's the type of fellow I think we need in the institution. And Elroy felt that way, after all, he was a high type fellow, a good representative of the University of Wisconsin, and should be on our staff.
Now this losing streak is...
It's a tough league.
It's not helped him.
No, because after all, if you're not filling that field house or you're not getting good receipts in basketball, it affects all the other sports. And now with the girls, we have some 21, 23 sports that we have to cover.
You did say basketball was one of the money makers.
It was at one time. It's not anymore.
It's not now?
Not now. No, if you figure the coach's salary and expenditure, travel and whatnot, it's not making money. People felt that boxing was making money, and it did. It covered itself and provided some additional funds that could be used for other sports. But here we almost have to have football, basketball, and hockey to carry us, because it's as you know. Inflation, everything's going up, and just have to have the receipts. And as long as we have to be self-supporting, so it's a little tough to run a intercollegiate program if one sport is down financially.
Well, particularly if it's one of the ones you count on to make money.
Yes, you count on to make money.
Okay.
We maybe should discuss whether any other sports were dropped or considered being dropped.
Well, we might talk of picking up boxing.
I'd be interested in that.
Yeah, we might talk of picking up boxing. We haven't dropped any sports. We have picked up... There was some agitation some years ago. Elroy had suggested the possibility of dropping crew, but the crewmen came to the fore and gave some help to crew. But Elroy actually, I think, did it for a reason. He wanted people to realize that crew was an expensive sport, and that unless we got some help, it was necessary to maybe retract on some of the sports. And so the crewmen did come to the fore, and of course they had various meetings, and they did raise some funds to buy some shells and some oars and provided some money to build a crew house.
Well, this surprises me a little, because I understood that at one time... Let me ask that again.
Where were we?
We're discussing the pressure to for coaches to either be successful and win their games, or if they have a long losing streak, to resign.
Well, it's unfortunate it has to be that way, but because in intercollegiate, you have the pressure from the alumni and friends of the university, your regents, your legislature. We get a little ribbing from some of the graduates of other schools that to win, and the pressure is always there from the outside. It's with our faculty, of course. There's really no gauge that you can place to check their win and loss records, so that. Their tenure is assured. Our people are on contract in intercollegiate athletics. Now they're on contract. They used to be have faculty rank. They used to be appointed as an assistant professor. A football coach would be an assistant professor. The head coach would be an associate professor or a professor. But of late years, they're all on contract. And the contracts vary. The head coach may have a 3 to 5 year contract. which would, in the case of football, the contract would be up as of January 1st, near the end of football season. So that if he were relieved of his duties, you could bring in another coach who could start his recruiting. In basketball and the other sports, the contract would run through the end of the fiscal year, which would be June 30th. But if they were apart, if the intercollegiate program was financed in part from state funds, bearing in mind that there would be athletic receipts there, but the total budget would be approved and the receipts would be thrown into the general fund. If that was the case, then you could tell the alumni and the others that we are running this operation as a part of the educational institution, and the outside pressures, true, they're there, but we're not going to pay too much attention to them because we have the personnel that are high-type individuals, represent the university well, and we're going to keep them. But we do know that even with that attitude, your athletic receipts, gate receipts, are going to fall, because if you aren't winning, the spectators are not going to be in the stands, and that's going to hurt your overall budget. So that it's an unfortunate situation, but it's a fact that that's the way it is. It's win or resign or be replaced by someone who can give you better contests, who can win your games. With the minor sports, the pressure isn't there because those boys and those coaches have the opportunity to participate at the expense at the present time of the football, basketball, and hockey. The pressure is there on those coaches, and as a result, the minors, so-called minor sports, have an opportunity to participate, and the pressure isn't there to relieve them if they don't win.
I can understand this, but why is there no state support for athletics? Why does it, or are they necessarily self-supporting?
Well, and I've got to check this out. I raised the question the other day, but I've always understood that we had to be self-supporting. The athletic department, as the intercollegiate department, was formed in 1913 by a legislative statute, 20.415C, established the intercollegiate athletic department. Years back, it was operated as a club or an association, but actually the 1913 legislature made it an official part, and the wording I've got to double check, but we have always understood that we had to be self-supporting. Any athletic receipts received on our behalf of the athletic department must be deposited with the state treasurer. There's probably no reason why they couldn't, but as you all know, every department in the university is competing for funds to operate.
Yes, that's certainly true.
And when the governor and the legislature say, put a lid on that, we're fighting for it. We do get some concessions now as to our scholarships, as the tuition. And the legislature, several years ago, passed a regulation that the university shall provide 270, not to exceed 270 tuition, free tuition, for the intercollegiate athletics. So that as a result, we're assigned, the university has said, well, now just a minute, you have made this regulation, but you haven't funded it. So when we figure a per student cost, and we give some free tuitions, it's costing the other departments. We're taking the money away from other departments. So because we have to budget on that basis, our per student cost. So if we give 270, it means that our per student cost is going to go up, which affects other departments in the university. But as a result, the university did set aside the equivalent in fees, student fees, a set amount that we have to work within. And as I recall, it was somewhere around $104,000. But it's probably been increased now with the increase in the reason. Previous to that time, each legislator could give a free scholarship. But everybody was fighting for those free scholarships. Some department had somebody that was a Spanish major or something, or a music major or something, they would go to the legislator and want to get his scholarship. The scholarship was set aside years ago as an athletic scholarship. Intent was athletic scholarship.
No, but it didn't have to be.
But it didn't have to be.
Oh.
It didn't have to be. So as a result, we were getting maybe 50 or 60 scholarships, and we have 133 members of the legislature, the Senate and the, and the Assembly. So what was intended originally didn't work out because we had to fight for those scholarships. But with this recent legislation, we do have an advantage there, so that we do have some help from the legislature. Well, we don't have any help because it comes from the university. The university has to give you free tuition. Because the legislatures, I think, took this attitude. If you've got 36,000 students there, what's the difference if you have 270 free ones? It's just a drop in the bucket. So that was their attitude. But the administration figures it differently. They figure, well, wait, if we give free ones, it's got to raise the unit cost someplace. So that is the only help the university has had. Our buildings have all been paid for out of athletic receipts. And over the years, we've been able to cover it. In fact, we would get to a point where we'd have a surplus, and the athletic board would say, geez, we better build something, or they're going to take it. Mentioned earlier, they did take $75,000 to build the Adams hall units. And for which George Little, in effect, got the intramural fields, which belonged to the university anyway. So it would be a nice arrangement. Some schools, now Michigan State, I understand, they have a budget, same as any other university department. And they estimate their athletic receipts, and the athletic receipts are thrown in the general fund. But their budget is a part of the university budget. Ours is a part. Intercollegiate athletics, of course, is a part of the university budget. But we have to budget up to our anticipated athletic receipts, so that we've got to be self-supporting. And our budget has increased. I can recall back in 1934, our budget was $96,000. And our salaries at that time were around $46,000. But the budget, well, when I left the department 3 years ago, our budget was about $1,800,000. So that things have really changed over the years.
Oh, yes. You mentioned that now with development of women's intercollegiate sports, this was going to put a strain on the athletic budget.
Well, I understand that I understand now that of course Title IX, which the NCAA is still fighting, since the Title IX said that it says that any institution that is federally receives federal funds must take into consideration, give equal consideration to both men and women, or give consideration to men and women. The NCAA has been fighting it, saying that intercollegiate athletics is not federally funded, and therefore should not come under that regulation. The Title IX, in their interpretation, has tried to indicate, the HEW has tried to indicate, that it should be equal. And that is where the problem is, that equal funds shall be provided both women's teams and men's teams. And that is where the bind comes in. Because if we were to say in basketball, if it costs us $50,000 for basketball, we would have to provide $50,000 for the women's basketball team as well. schedules can be arranged that could be, would not have to use that much money. So the intercollegiate departments feel that they should be able to administer their own operation. They would have men's teams and women's team, but it should be under the direction of the intercollegiate athletic department as to how much shall be appropriated for each group. The travel, of course, and all that sort of thing was, according to HEW, shall be equal. If you fly a man's team, you should fly a woman's team.
Well, it wasn't equal, as I understand it.
No,
prior to this.
No, because intercollegiate athletics was a men's department entirely.
I realize.
The women had their own athletic department, but under HEW, or under this Title IX, the feeling is that they must provide competition for the women. They did have competition, but under their own setup, Lathrop Hall was the women's gymnasium.
But they had to pay for any travel themselves, whereas
true,
men's
yeah.
groups, even
yeah.
minor sports, did
yeah.
not. Isn't that
That's
correct?
True. That's true, yeah. Because that all came out of the men's intercollegiate athletic receipts, you see. And it might come to pass that the women will be able to accumulate some money for their athletic teams. I mean, gate receipts and whatnot. It's the interest has to be built over the years, I think. Now, down in Iowa, they had women's basketball teams for years that used to play in high school. And they would play, the men's teams would play their games, and then the women would take over them. In many schools in Iowa, the girls' team was a major team. They had some good tournaments down there. That hadn't been the case in Wisconsin, because for years, the women did not have teams in high school. And it's just recently that they're generating that, so it's going to take some time to generate good competition that would have an interest to the general public who would come out and view those and pay to see them, which would, of course, generate revenue. But that isn't the case at the present time. And of course, I think the feeling has been that the men's department, through men's competition over the years, have built the buildings, have provided opportunities for, in their own buildings that they paid for out of athletic receipts, for physical education and others to use those facilities, and also to provide for many other men's minor sports, that the football, basketball, and hockey has provided that money, of course, to conduct other men's intercollegiate sports. But Title IX says now that we should have all sports, which is being accepted and is operating, but it's going to take a little while to build the budgets and whatnot. And the unfortunate thing is that they legislated, but did not provide any funds. And that's when the men's intercollegiate program has felt that if the federal government was going to dictate what you should do, they should also provide some funds to provide it. We give funds to aid every country of the universe, but why can't they appropriate some money to the departments or the universities to make it possible to carry out these programs that they have legislated? But we had an attorney from HEW talk to us 2 years ago, and the money was raised, the question was raised. Said, "Oh, about the funding." Said, "Well, that's your problem. They make the rule, but they don't provide the means to carry out the rule." But they say that's up to you to raise funds. I think at the present time, the university has appropriated about $94,000 for the women's program, and the athletic department, the intercollegiate, well, the men's department, the funds from the intercollegiate department. That's one now anyway. But I think the budget for this year, I think Elroy mentioned it was about $160,000, and we'll grow, or $180,000, and we'll of course grow. And that
difference between 94,000 and the under 80,000 has to be made up from gate receipts. And they're tapping a source that's overtapped now. Because if you're going to conduct what you've conducted over the years, you're going to have to cut back someplace. And where are you going to cut? You're going to have to cut some of the activities that have been carried on for years. So that's where the crux of the whole thing is. I just received a memo from the NCA. They've hired an attorney now to fight this regulation, the interpretation by ATW of the Title IX, to the effect that intercollegiate is not federally funded, therefore it should not come under Title IX. That's the argument of the NCA. But they will carry out. They realize that participation for both men and women should be carried on, but that the department should be able to operate themselves and not have federally controlled.
So the resistance is really a financial matter, and not the principle of equal opportunity for women to have intercollegiate.
Because it's a problem of facilities, it's a problem of finances to take care of uniforms, transportation, feeding them on trips, feeding them if you're going to have a training table and that sort of thing. It's financial entirely. I think the feeling generally has been good with the athletic departments. If someone would only provide some facilities, because you've dumped a bunch of people into a building, and where do you put them? You've got your capacity right now. Now where do you put them? You throw somebody out to bring in somebody new, and that's where the whole argument is. So you've got to have additional facilities. The practice building, of course, has provided some additional locker rooms. They took what we used as our boiler room there and renovated that. There was a big boiler in there, and it cost the athletic department $75,000 to put in a heating system, which was never used. They decided that when we built the practice building, that the day might come when the central heating department could not heat the stadium and fieldhouse and the practice building, so that we should provide for some possibility of heating those units, especially the practice building. So we spent $75,000, and I know we had a boiler, and the boiler is still under the sod there on the north of the practice building. We had 10,000 gallons of oil in that. We had to fill the tank in order to hold it in the ground. But now that it's been in there for years, since 1956, they drained out the oil several years ago, and we're supposed to get credit for that oil.
It's worth more today.
Yeah. But they pumped it out in order to utilize it some years ago. But they did provide some additional locker facilities for the women, which is very good. So that relieves the thing. We've had to share a training room with the women who've been very good about it. They specify time when they can come in so that they don't interfere with the men's operation. We do have a girl trainer there that see to the needs of the girls in case they get cut or bruised or bumped or whatever they need. If they need a rub down or need therapy, and they need the whirlpool and that sort of thing. Provision is made for them. And I think Kit Saunders there is a women's athletic director doing a good job. She's very, very reasonable and understands the problem. And that's what it takes. A lot of some of the departments, I know Kermit Perry, I just was transcribing his talk, and we did have a Dr. Gordon from Washington talk to our College Athletic Business Managers Association. She gave us information from the women's standpoint, and Perry then talked about how they're actually handling it at his school and the problems involved, but they just don't have a big a big department, big huge facilities that they could expand in. And taking old locker, old storerooms and whatnot, renovating them, trying to make a place for the girls. It's quite a problem. It'll come, but it's going to take some time. And well, it would be hopeful if the legislature would appropriate some money to help out the situation, so that we can put them on the hall. Because after all, you don't like to have your girls out driving at midnight to get back to school and that sort of thing to save a little money. It's dangerous. They should have an opportunity too. But I don't think the pressure is going to be on the women's coaches for many, many years. I think their tenure now, our girls' basketball probably have as poor a record as our men's basketball team this year. But I don't think the pressure will be there to replace the coach.
I see.
Because there isn't the interest. When the interest grows, then the pressure is going to be there. I think our girls are going to be fine.
Women's intercollegiate athletics is, after all, what, only 2 years old?
It is 2 years old. And you wonder, too, what percentage of the population, the student population of the girls, is actually participating. That we can only tell in a few years to see what we crew has been very popular.
With women?
With women, yes, but very popular. And they've been very successful. Even in the, well, of course the girls' crew, they've been operating a little longer than just 2 years.
Oh, have they?
Oh, yes. They've been out there in the boats. Randy has had them off the boats earlier than that. Carl Holtz, who was one of our top crewmen, and who was with us from Keep Team 41, has a daughter who's participating on the crew now, and that's rather interesting. But I just met her in our W Club meeting here just recently. But girls, very the most popular seems to be not handball, but the basketball is fairly popular, but it's a little strenuous for the girls. But the volleyball seems to be the most popular of the girls' sports. They seem to have more out for volleyball than they do have out for basketball. And that was Perry's thought too when they checked at their school that volleyball seemed to be more popular than most of the other. Track is a little strenuous for girls too, because they don't. I noticed one of the girls yesterday talking to our shot putter and our discus man, and he was demonstrating to her how you should do it. So I imagine she's getting interested in discus.
It's possible,
sure. Yeah, but that little shot. Of course, they can probably throw the 12-pound shot, the 16-pound shot's a little heavy for.
Yes,
I would think
sounds
for the girls.
Sounds to me, anyway.
But it'll come in time, but it does take time, and I think the men are kind of hopeful that the girls will be a little patient about it. And of course, they only have 4 years here in school, so they want to participate, they're going to get out early. And now the freshmen can participate. Another thing is the question, are they going to have to maintain the same eligibility standards? Or is that's up for question?
Oh, this hasn't been decided?
I don't think that's been entirely resolved as yet. But there is a question whether or not they're going to have to, live up to the same standards. I think that our athletic board has taken the stand that if they're going to compete, they're going to have to maintain the same eligibility standards as the men's.
Offhand, it seems quite reasonable to me.
Well, sure, I think it does, yeah. Yeah, they have to have a prediction of 1.6. Of course, scholarships are a question, whether or not they're going to get scholarships. I don't know as of now whether or not there are any girls' scholarships. But,
I don't know either.
But there's another avenue that they may want to push and say, well, if the men are getting scholarships, why can't we have scholarships? So it's entirely financial from our standpoint. I think the men are all agreed that it's good for the girls to compete in certain sports. And time may come that they will compete on men's teams. I see no reason why they couldn't compete on tennis teams and golf teams and track teams. And in fact, some schools have said, okay, if you can make the team, we have a team. We don't have a girls' team, but we have a team. If you can make it, you can play. If you're good enough to make our tennis team or our golf team or our basketball team, swimming team, if you're good enough, good, you can make it. But you got to compete with the boys. But most of them feel, I think, that, well, the girls should compete against the girls.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some girls who won't share this view.
Yeah, that's true, sure. And some girls feel, well, why shouldn't I compete? I can beat him in tennis. I can beat him in golf. Why shouldn't I compete on the golf team or the tennis team? I know that those are, or the fencing team. Those are certain teams that girls could very well qualify as well as the men. They're more agile than men in fencing. And in tennis, tennis is not as a strenuous sport, but the girls do very well in it. So time may come that they'll compete with the men's team. So
I guess we'll have to wait and see.
I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, we're getting.
Been just 1 point difference. We would have tied the match.
Oh boy.